certainly favorable in the Catskills and the Hudson Valley. It's favorable on the island. In New York City, it's a toss-up. Either way, 1%. 1% negative, even 1% positive. And, you know, most of the people are located in New York City. So, and I'm always trusting the wisdom of the people. If the referendum passes, 10% would go to that host community.
10% of
the city, village, town, or county.
10% of what?
10% of the casino proceeds, slots, and table games. 10% of those proceeds generated from these casinos, Class 3, would go to a commercial gaming fund to be deposited, 10% to the host community, 10% to the surrounding communities in that region, and 80% to the rest of the state of New York to be earmarked for education and property tax relief. No formula, subject to be distributed according to budget negotiations, but that excess monies from gaming would be had to be used for education and property tax relief.
So let's say so I'm a voter and it's November 5th now, and you know, I'm kind of on the fence. I'm wondering, you know, what's your position in terms of why should I vote for this amendment? What's the benefit to me as a New Yorker?
Okay. So if you live upstate, one of the benchmarks that we've already established when we were going forward before with Native American casinos was that you had to have an initial investment of $600 million when you applied for that license. And these would be private sector money, of course, for construction jobs, a minimum of 1,000 jobs per licensee had to be created. So if you were in these three regions, it's certainly job creation that could be directly attributed to a resort. I always say a casino, but in my mind, we're looking for a resort destination with all the amenities like a Las Vegas, with all the golf, tennis, spas, entertainment, restaurants. That to me is the attraction, not necessarily the gaming casino. But to come back to why you should vote, that would be a game changer for job creation for people that are looking for jobs or want to switch jobs. They're decent paying jobs. There are health benefits. And I understand, although I can't guarantee this part of it, there would be pension programs. And there will be a what I call a multiplier effect. That will help other businesses. And you know, just take Foxwoods up in Connecticut. They spend $100 million a year back into the communities to purchase goods to help, you know, generate economic vitality. So we see this as a game changer for those host communities and surrounding counties to help with job creation.
Okay. This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with Senator John Bonasek, the chair of the New York State Senate's Judiciary Committee.
And racing and wagering. So we have two hats.
You don't get paid for both of them, though.
No, we do not.
You only get paid for the higher of the two.
Now, that would be a game changer.
Now, I want to come back to your question. I'm a New Yorker in New York City, and I'm not going to have any of these resorts in close proximity to where I am. The carrot to the people in New York City, and for that matter to the island and Westchester and below, they don't qualify for these four licenses, but they would qualify for 80% of the proceeds being distributed statewide to help with their schools and to help with property tax relief. And also, there would be choices for quality of life if they wanted to go to a resort, you know, to drive upstate in close proximity and enjoy the beauty and the resources of upstate New York and have an opportunity to visit resorts throughout those three regions that I discussed with you.
So Senator, you're obviously a supporter of casino gambling. What do you say to, or how do you answer critics of gambling who point to places like Atlantic City or Niagara Falls, places that have considerable blight in their backyards?
Well, first of all, I will let Governor Christie talk to those people. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, I don't think Atlantic City, as a practical matter, did their strategic plan right. They promised many things to happen off the boardwalk with investments in housing and a rebuilding of economic development and education, and I don't think they kept their promises. And so I don't say to the people that casino is a catalyst for true economic development. It's a catalyst for economic vitality, job creation. Gaming in and of itself is never a catalyst for economic development. And there's competition all over the country where gaming. We have it all around us. We have it in Canada, Connecticut, Jersey, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts is doing it. But I would tell the people in our state that we have people that enjoy going to resorts. They enjoy gaming if that's what they like to do, but some go to resorts just to enjoy family activities with all the amenities. And I will tell you that when I go to Vegas, and maybe I've been there five times in my life, like one out of six or seven people actually go in the casino. Many of them go for all of the resort amenities and the shows and family fun. And with us, with Four Seasons, I see that as particularly attractive to people that have families that want to ski or ice skate or hike or do whatever they want to do in the Four Seasons. But we are losing a tremendous amount of money now that is going to these surrounding states for these resort destinations and gaming. And it would be important to recapture that money for our general fund for education and property tax relief.
Well, that's a very good point, and I was just about to ask you about that. So proponents of casinos point to the additional state revenue and the revenue that it'll bring to local communities. So what do you think has to happen for those expectations for revenue to be realized?
Well, first of all, our tourism is up generally, people coming from outside the state of New York to visit upstate New York and the metropolitan area. It gives locals, New Yorkers and out-of-staters, an opportunity to have a different quality of life experience if they want to revisit these resort destinations. So I see more activity and more utilization to help the tourism industry and also to bring people into those resorts to add revenues our general fund and to capture revenues that have been going outside the state.
Do you have an expectation in your mind of, you know, assuming it's passed and it works, you know, the four casinos are sited in a expeditious fashion. I don't know if it'll take a year or two.
It'll take about 2 years.
Right. So however long it takes, do you or the other supporters of this have an expectation of what the state revenue that might be generated and what the local revenue might be that's generated?
First of all, it's a great question. And this is the governor's program, Bill. So I don't have, you know, a budget analysts that tell me this, but the governor has said that the expectation is over an increase of over $1 billion.
A billion a year?
A billion a year.
For state and local together?
Yes, generated out of the casino expectation. And then you would go off your percentages off that. 10% local, 10%. Keep in mind, we're talking of gaming now.
Right. That's what we were asking about. So we unfortunately don't have more time. It sounds like we could talk for a long time. So thank you very much for taking the time to be with us this morning. We've been speaking with Senator John Bonasek about the casino gambling constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot on this November's general election, November 5th. Senator, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
I've enjoyed it, and if you want to do a subsequent show for more questions, I'd gladly join in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a brief break right now. Soon we'll be back with Daniel Hunter, who's the author of a new book called Strategy and Soul. He's going to be speaking about his experiences as the chief strategist for a grassroots movement called Casino Free Philadelphia.
They call, send letters, email, and visit your home. They're not friends or family. They're con artists, scammers, and criminals. In times like these, it's important to learn how to protect yourself. Credit card schemes, bogus investment opportunities, and free vacation scams are just a few ways that today's criminals target you and your family. Protect yourself. Never give anyone your social security number, credit card, or bank account information unless you initiated the call. Stay informed of current scams by contacting your Attorney General's office and Better Business Bureau. If you're a victim, reporting the con to the local authorities will prevent others from suffering the same fate. To learn more about how to keep your family safe from con artists and scams, visit ncpc.org. That's ncpc.org. A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome back to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. I'm Frank Morrow and I'm here in Troy in the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute George Lowe Center with Brian McDonald and Ron Deutsch. And we're pleased to be joined on the telephone by Daniel Hunter. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I learned about Daniel and Casino Free Philadelphia from his new book, Strategy and Soul, which is about this grassroots movement for which he was the chief strategist. Casino gambling wasn't a subject Daniel was involved with until October 2006, when he got a call from a friend, another community organizer who was trying to take a sabbatical from organizing, and that friend's neighborhood in Philadelphia was being targeted for development by one of the several competing developers. Daniel, before we ask you about what New Yorkers can learn from the experiences of Casino Free Philadelphia and from your book, Strategy and Soul, tell us a little of what happened after the call you received from your friend Jethro in October 2006.
Well, at that time, I didn't know anything about casino gambling in Pennsylvania, and so Jethro calls me up and says they're trying to build a 5,000 slot parlor right across the street from his home in Fishtown in Philadelphia. So this is, just to give a sense, 5,000 slots is larger than any casino in Atlantic City or Las Vegas, more slots. And they're trying to build this right in a residential neighborhood. And so he began telling me about the process, how we had gotten casinos as a backdoor deal, and how it was being touted as an economic development engine, but there was no real plan. And his background is community development, and he'd said there's been no real infrastructure to think about how did casinos get built in neighborhoods. And so while he wasn't opposed at the time to casinos entirely, he was saying it's a terrible deal for our neighborhood, and trying to put a casino right in any neighborhood is unwanted. So he pitched me on trying to get involved in the campaign, and right away I got involved, mostly as a democracy issue. And over the course of the years, we began to get moved on it and eventually became anti-casino as we learned more about the industry itself.
So we're here with Brian McDonald, who's the legislative and political director for ASPE, and Ron Deutsch from New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. And we're going to dig into the Casino Free Philadelphia experience a little bit right now. So I'll turn it over to Brian.
So, Daniel, from the work that you and others did for Casino Free Philadelphia, What do you see as the problems with casino development in cities, particularly in residential neighborhoods? And then can you compare that to a place like New York that currently has casinos that are often located in rural areas?
Yeah. I mean, the number one problem with casinos, no matter where you put them, is that it increases the number of people who are the number of problem gamblers. And on the one hand, there's the moral issue of what does it do to families that you see people who become problem gamblers and lose all their money, they go bankrupt, and that often results in huge loss of life or people who break up their families, suicides, all these things increase. So there's that as sort of the moral and social issues. But I think the number one reason that we ended up becoming opposed to casinos in Philadelphia is for every dollar that's lost in a casino, that's money that's moved out of your economy. And so that's money that's moved out of Philadelphia and instead goes into the pockets of investors who live in Chicago or live in the suburbs or live outside of our outside of Philadelphia. And so what we saw was every single dollar that the casinos gain as profit is money that's moved out of your economy. And so that's money that becomes, I mean, in a way, casinos, the way we began talking about it is casinos are cannibalistic. That is, they take from every other industry. They take from movie theaters, they take from restaurants, and they compete. And so what we were worried about and what we've seen here in Philadelphia is right around the casinos, we see an sort of shriveling effect where what happens is more and more industries are hit really hard because people aren't putting money in restaurants or small businesses or other kinds of industries that are either union dense or labor dense, and instead we see money going into these investors' pockets out of the city. So the fact that they give some money back, I mean, the senator was talking about that, and you know, the fact that they give some money back, it just never adds up.
Right. So we're talking to Daniel Hunter, the author of Strategy and Soul, about his experiences with the Casino Free Philadelphia grassroots movement. That's exactly what I wanted to ask about, saying that the money is taken out of the community. It sounds like, from what Senator Bonasek said, that in New York, 10% would go to various, in effect, public uses, and the other 90% would go to the casino operator. And your theory is that the casino operators basically are not local businesses, and the money. So the 90% of the revenue that's generated, or the take 90% of the gross revenue would go someplace else. What's the profitability? So is getting 10% of the gross revenues a good deal, or is there still going to be a lot of economic loss?
It's a terrible deal. They'll throw out big numbers. So, I mean, especially now that you're in the stage where they're trying to pitch it, they'll throw incredibly high numbers. I mean, for example, we were told that the casinos would offer up to 13,000 spinoff jobs. And it's not even a 13th of that. So the casinos are happy to lie and sort of trout out huge amounts of numbers. And I'm surprised, actually, that the senator is buying it, because that's less and less common. But it's because there's more evidence that just shows that's not true. But, like, I'll just give a quick example. So in Philadelphia, the state, what they say is the casino industry itself generated about $426 million for local municipalities. But what we've lost is $12 billion have been moved out of the economy. So those numbers just don't add. I mean, yes, so they gave some pittance back, but at the end of the day, the casinos understand this is a good deal for them. That's why they're advocating. They're all investors who understand economics, and what they're hoping on is that we don't. And so that's the number one reason why they were so pushing the economic argument, because it's actually their weakest argument. Because at the end of the day, yes, some money does come back, but that's money that's ours to begin with. And instead of moving it through the economy, it ends up just moving out. Mm. So it becomes a real loss. And studies have backed this up consistently. I mean, that's why he couldn't answer the question of Atlantic City. He couldn't answer the answer of Niagara, Detroit. Any of these cities, whether they're rural or urban, all have had the same experience. And the only way that doesn't, there is one exception, and I want to point this out, which is the only way that doesn't happen is if you're Las Vegas. That is to say, if you're getting new people to come to your state. And so the casinos will begin arguing, we're going to be a resort destination. And so their argument is, we'll bring people in from other states. But the problem is, in New York, that's not going to happen. You already have casinos surrounding you on all sides, on Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. So it's not going to be new money that's coming into the economy. It's going to be people who are already in your economy, and those people will become increasing addicts. I mean, this is the only industry that creates its own customer base. And addiction is the heart and soul of the casino industry. So it's a predatory industry where you're looking at upwards of 80 to 90% of all of their money comes from 10% of their customer base. So what they're looking at is they're looking at a small set of the population that they heavily hit, and the language they use is they try to play them to extinction, which means they try to get every dollar that they have access to.
That's interesting. This is Ron Deutsch, and I do want to welcome you as well, Daniel, to the People's Business here on WRPI in Troy. And I would say, you know, far be it from our elected officials to exaggerate the revenue projections or the multiplier effect when they talk about this as an economic development initiative, as they do with most economic development initiatives that they're pushing here in New York State. But let me get back to this here. I mean, Casino Free Philadelphia, your work took place after the expansion of casino gambling in Pennsylvania had been authorized, and you had a casino gaming control board that was considering different applications and competing applications for specific casino development projects. So that's likely could be the situation here in New York if voters say yes to this constitutional amendment in November. So if the voters do say yes, you know, what advice do you have for community groups and municipalities in dealing with this resort gaming facility location board that's going to be created? You know, what if a locality doesn't want a casino in their area? How would they go about fighting this, or what advice would you provide to them?
One of the things that I started to have a lot of conversations with people about early on in our campaign, because, as you say, we were behind the times. I mean, we didn't see this coming. It had gotten snuck at the last deal, the last moment. And so part of what we need to do as organizers is build a bigger story that can gather people who may not necessarily get it right away. And so for us, as organizers, that happened in two ways, and I just want to emphasize them. So one was we ran our first campaign on the issue of transparency. We could have taken on casinos as money. We could have taken them as bad development. But we wanted to pick one that we thought was a widely shared value that we could show right away this is how the casino industry is one aspect of it being wrong. And the aspect was they weren't sharing site plans, architectural renderings, environmentalist plans, social impact studies, labor relations, any of these kinds of things, documentation about how they would actually operate. So the senator is saying, you know, look, they've got great plans, but actually in our case, and I believe in New York too, they're actually quite cagey about those plans because they don't want to make those very public. So we ran our first campaign, Operation Transparency, based on a very simple proposition. We want all of those documents made public. If those documents are not made public by a particular date, it was December 1st at high noon, if they're not made public by that date, then we'll have to go to the Game Control Board and take it ourselves using a nonviolent document search. So we would literally go into their offices and liberate the text. So that's the direct action approach. You heard that exactly right.
Yes.
So it's a direct action approach which says we need to have some creativity, but we also need to show people they can still win things. If the government itself won't do the right thing, then we'll have to. And we'll have to do the right thing. And so that was our first campaign right off the bat, which was sending a signal to government and politicians, we have a way of playing with you that's not rooted in the notion that you hold all the cards.
Right.
So that was important.
So
I think the second
people
thing,
power versus money, really, right?
Exactly. And I think a second thing was also really important, which was, well, and we had a way of carrying it out. So it wasn't just we believe in people power, we'll hold a rally. It was rather, we believe in people power, and we'll give an example of exactly how we would pull this off. Hmm. So without going through the whole story, in the end, we were, in fact, able to get about 95% of these documents released through our pressure. So the fact that we were able to win some things, that's very important. That's one. But the second thing, I think, is also important, which was we refused to be on our opponent's timetable. And so our big, in the way that you have the upcoming election, our big date was a December 20th date. And so people were sort of all focused on that deadline. And what we realized is, win or lose, we need people focused beyond that deadline. And so even while that deadline was coming up, we began organizing for a large strategy retreat where people could, I think our date was January 6th, where people would get to come and gather together to begin thinking about what do they do next. So rather than just waiting until we found out the results of what was December 20th, we already began moving onto our own timeline by putting out this January 6th date. And I think it's important for people who are working in these communities or people who want to work, want to give support to these folks in communities, which is the date itself is not the final thing. And what the casinos will tell you is once this vote happens, that's it. It's over. It's done. And that's their story. Their story in every municipality I've ever worked in is always it's a done deal. And that storyline is important because if people believe that, then they give up. And if people give up, then it is a done deal. But if people don't give up, then it's not. And that's a lot of what we proved and sort of showed how we do that as organizers, both on any issue, but particularly on this issue.
We're speaking to Daniel Hunter, who is the author of a new book, Strategy and Soul. It's about a grassroots movement, Casino Free Philadelphia, with which he was an important part. Tell us a little about why you wrote Strategy and Soul and what effect you hope it will have.
Well, I'm an organizer, I'm an activist, and I've worked in a lot of different campaigns. And one of the things I've been interested in the last sort of 10 years has been how do we teach people strategy? That is, how do we teach organizers, regular citizens, how do you win on campaigns that look unwinnable? And so I do training professionally, and I support organizations and strategic consulting and other kinds of things. But what I realized in writing this book was one of the most effective ways to learn is through story. And so what I do in this book is I'm bringing people into the heart and soul of what organizing looks like. It's not just it's not written in a sort of generic, here's the five things you should do for organizing, but really in the heart and soul of, so we did a direct action, we announced this ultimatum, then what? How do we talk to reporters? Then what? And it's written almost like a spy novel where you don't know what's coming next because, like a good movement, you don't know what's coming next. And we never knew it was coming next. I mean, we got surprised and so forth. And so both, I wanted to capture both the strategic dimension of it and also the emotional dimension of campaigning because it's tough, it's hard, it's exhausting. You feel alone or you feel hopeless. I mean, you go through your own personal journey about that. And so you get to carry that with me through the book as well. So I just got a letter from a labor union in New Zealand who's using the book and very excited to share it with their membership because they're just finding it so helpful in terms of teaching them about what the real groundwork is of strategy in a campaign, even though they're, of course, not on the same issue.
Daniel, before we finish up, we've got a couple more minutes. Let's go back to the economic arguments and the way Casino Free Philadelphia developed them. In looking at some of the materials on your website, you had a summary piece where you said, we talk about why casinos aren't worth it, but let's lay out our strategy. And one of the arguments you make is that not only does casino gambling not revitalize a place like Atlantic City, but that it actually increases blight.
Oh, yeah.
Why is that? I mean, I know your answer, so it's sort of a setup question, but what's the economic reasoning?
Well, I mean, it goes a little bit back to what I said, which is the fundamental transition, the fundamental thing casinos are efficient at is they're the most efficient mechanism I know of moving money from poor people to rich people. So from middle-class families and regular folk to very extraordinarily wealthy people. And this is the uber-rich.
And the extraordinarily wealthy people are the casino owners?
Are the casino investors, yeah.
Okay.
Casino owners. And so in Atlantic City, part of what happens is that the industry itself, and I'll speak almost, I'm regularly amazed that politicians don't get this right away. But that when you invite the casino industry into your town, they now have a controlling interest in your town. You almost become a little bit of a company town, and we're experiencing that in Philly with one casino already, which is, this is a massive industry who moves huge amounts of money through its economy and moves huge amounts of money out of the economy. So that's money that's not available to local facilities, etc. Once, I can guarantee you, once the casinos get in, that 10% that they're promising, they'll negotiate it down. They'll say, we need, economic times are hard, we need to negotiate it down to 8%, 7%, 6%. That's what they did in Atlantic City, is they kept negotiating to give further and further, less and less and less. And the politicians aren't in a great shape to negotiate and push back on the casino industry because they feel so related to it and so desperate. So you've brought in an industry who only has its interest in mind. So we were told that the casinos will help support Philadelphia schools. And the within 3 years of the casino opening here in Philadelphia, we're at a desperate spot in our Philadelphia schools. And there's no evidence whatsoever that any of that money is making a difference.
Right. I mean, in the last year, it's been in the news that more than 20 schools in Philadelphia were scheduled for closing.
That's right. And so we end up closing 13. So it's been devastating. And so the industry lies, the industry manipulates. I mean, that's everything that a industry who's trying to, you know, get their foot in the door might try to do. But it's especially important to understand, once they're in the door, they then can get to negotiate for what they want.
Right.
And they don't want quality development in your city. What they want is they want access to people, and they want an ability to bring new people into their facility. So everything that they say about spinoff is untrue in every case we've researched that's not Atlantic City.
Wow.
Or Las Vegas.
We're going to have to go. We could talk forever, it sounds like. But it's wonderful. This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we have been speaking with Daniel Hunter, the author of a new book, Strategy and Soul, about a grassroots movement, Casino Free Philadelphia, with which he was an important part. Daniel, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Hey, thanks so much for talking today.
Thanks, Daniel.
This has been a fascinating conversation. We're going to take a brief break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Neil Murray of the O'Connell and Aronowitz Law Firm. We're going to talk to Neil about a lawsuit he's filed challenging some of the key components of the casino gambling constitutional amendment. We'll be right back.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome back to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness.
This is Brian McDonnell. We're pleased now to be joined on the telephone by Neil Murray of the O'Connell and Aronowitz Law Firm, which is headquartered here in Albany. Neil, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest, Neil Murray, is an expert on health law, focusing on complex Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement issues, but he's also developed a reputation for challenging federal and state governmental action or inaction in the unique and often complex area of gaming law. Neil, today we want to focus on the current lawsuit in which you're representing the towns of Vernon and Verona in challenging Governor Cuomo's deal with the Oneida Indians on the proposed casino gambling constitutional amendment. Before we do that, can you tell us a little bit about your background in this area and some of the victories you had in 2003 and 2008 in two earlier casino gambling lawsuits? One was called Saratoga County Chamber of Commerce versus Pataki. The other was Citizens Against Casino Gambling versus Hogan in 2008.
Right. Well, what I've been involved in, Frank, essentially started about a decade ago when the former Governor Cuomo had previously entered into a compact with the Oneida Indian Nation, and then they sought to amend that compact And at the time, the groups that I represented were concerned about the proliferation of gambling throughout the state, and in particular, Indian gaming. And it came to our attention at that time that the governor, the first governor, Cuomo, had actually entered into that compact without any legislative authorization. And when he sought to amend the compact and expand it and also enter into a separate compact with the Mohawk Indians, we went into court in the state of New York and asked the court to enjoin and declare this illegal on the grounds that the governor had not sought legislative authorization. A major policy initiative like this requires at least legislative participation, and up until that point in time, the legislature had not been involved. So we were successful in striking it down on those grounds. It's important to understand that it wasn't a total victory in the sense that this could be remediated by the legislature later enacting legislation authorizing the governor to do what he had unilaterally done, and indeed that subsequently did happen. So we won a battle. We did not win the war.
Thanks. Neil, this is Ron Deutsch, and I also want to welcome you to the People's Business here at WRPI in Troy, but it seems you're representing the towns of Vernon and Verona, and that involves the casino gambling constitutional amendment that's scheduled to be on the ballot November 5th. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. As you know, for a long time, the Oneidas and the other Indian tribes were opposed to the proposed constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot, as you mentioned, in November. And, of course, the obvious reason why they were opposed to it was because, presently, because they are uniquely situated as Indians, they're not subject to the same constitutional prohibitions that the rest of the people are, and they've been able to operate their casinos essentially as monopolies without any competition. When the proposed constitutional amendment was first introduced and approved by the legislature, the obvious concern that preoccupied, I think, both all the Indian tribes was, uh-oh, this is potential competition for us. And there was many outspoken opposition to it, a lot of outspoken opposition to it by the tribes. And all of a sudden, we knew that the governor was politically invested in trying to get this constitutional amendment as an engine for economic development, pulled out all the stops, literally, to silence the opposition of the tribe. And what happened was that there were secret negotiations that the governor entered into, specifically with the Oneidas, in which he found a way to essentially silence them and buy their vote, and I think in a way that subverts the democratic process. And essentially what the deal was is, listen, Oneidas, you have an application that we have been opposing in federal court to take up to 25,000 acres or 17,000 acres of land in central New York, remove it from the sovereign jurisdiction of the state of New York. We've vehemently opposed that, and we've sued you. But I'll tell you what we'll do. If you will agree to this constitutional amendment and not speak out against it and, in fact, support it, we'll drop our lawsuit. And we will not only drop our lawsuit for 17,000 acres of land, which you're seeking to take in central New York, we'll let you take up to 25,000 acres. We'll give you a geographical monopoly on gambling in a 10-county area in central New York. That land will be free as well from, and the 25,000 acres of land will be free from taxation. And as a consequence of that, the little towns of Vernon and Verona see their tax base eroded. More significantly even than that is the loss of sovereign jurisdiction, not only by the towns of Vernon and Verona, but the counties of Madison and Oneida, and indeed the state of New York, over that 25,000 acres of land. It's a huge giveaway, in exchange for which the tribe agrees to drop its opposition to the constitutional amendment, and indeed not fund any campaigns against it, and to actively support it. And that is the quid pro quo. And they have to agree agree to that. That's a quintessential part of the deal. So we have brought a lawsuit challenging that, not only on the policy issue of whether gambling is good or not good, but the more fundamental concern about the fact that the state of New York can't be giving away its sovereign jurisdiction in exchange for and a geographical monopoly to a tribe in support of their vote for a constitutional amendment. And if, there's no question that this is an explicit, it's not a tacit or implicit agreement. The agreement itself spells out the fact that the tribe is required to support the constitutional amendment and not fund any opposition to it, in exchange for which the payoff is 25,000 acres of land, a geographical monopoly, and tax-free enterprises on the land that they operate.
We're speaking with Neil Murray from the law firm of O'Connell and Aronowitz, and he's representing the towns of Vernon and Verona in a legal challenge to the agreement that the governor reached with the Oneida Indian Nation. Now, the lawsuit, Neil, the towns are asking the court to declare illegal the agreement. What's the implication of that? What does it mean? Does it just mean that they've already made the agreement? What's the effect of declaring it illegal?
Well, I think there's two things. First of all, it would stop the agreement in federal. There's a separate lawsuit in federal court right now where the state has actively opposed the Oneida's application for land in the trust. It's a quintessential part of the deal that the tribe has to support this particular constitutional amendment and not oppose it. If the deal gets struck down, then the settlement in federal court on the 25,000 acres of land is off the table. And that's the important part. The second part is that we think when the people go to the polls in November, they need to know what led up to this constitutional amendment, what the deal was, what the quid pro quo was, what the buying of the votes was. And we think it's important that if we're able to, and I'll talk a minute about some of the delay tactics that I think are being involved here. There's a late development, which I'm sure you don't know about yet, but I'll tell you in a second. But in any event, we think it's important that a court make a determination as to the underlying validity of this quid pro quo so that when the people go to the polls, they'll know that there's been an attempt to buy off the Indians and the fact that the state has given away so much in exchange for getting the Oneidas to support this constitutional amendment. Now, the development, not to keep you in suspense, I don't want to be dramatic here, but we were supposed to be in court tomorrow in Albany, in state Supreme Court, challenging this. At the proverbial last second, the state filed papers seeking to remove this case to federal court, and on the grounds that we raised a federal constitutional question about people being denied equal protection under the law because the opposition and the state was buying votes. Because of that federal question, the case automatically gets transferred to federal court. That in and of itself is a delay, but we will be taking actions to get this case as soon as possible transferred back into state court.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised about, you know, secret backroom Albany deals. The governor has a long history of being able to kind of sideline his opposition, and, you know, this seems like another quid pro quomo kind of situation.
Good pun.
And I guess I'm wondering, you know, you're up against it here, Neil. I mean, you're up against the state and the governor. You're up against the casino industry, which has extremely deep pockets. So I'm wondering, you know, what do you put your odds at for winning a case like this?
Well, I learned a long time ago, never, you know, the fact that the opposition is powerful doesn't change the facts or the law. And, yeah, this is a bit of a David and Goliath struggle. There's no question about it. If you can get the court to focus on the issues and, you know, just put the politics aside, which is what a court, of course, is supposed to do, and just look at this, I remain confident that the court will do the right thing. And I think it's so transparent, it's so blatant, when you would put something in writing like that. In fact, I'm shocked that they would do it. But to answer your question, yes, the opposition is powerful. They're well-financed. But that's why we have courts of law, to try to level the playing field.
We're speaking with Neil Murray of the O'Connell and Aranos Law Firm about a lawsuit in which he's representing the towns of Vernon and Verona. So the remedy is important for what happens in federal court, but it doesn't seem like this would lead to the canceling of the referendum.
No, it shouldn't lead to the canceling of the referendum. I wouldn't ask a court to do that. The people have a right, obviously, to vote on a proposed constitutional amendment. But the other thing that concerns me here, and what we haven't mentioned in this lawsuit as well, is that when the people go to the polls, they may not understand that they're not only voting for a constitutional amendment, they're voting for how this legislature this past year already enacted provisions into law as to how that constitutional amendment would be implemented. And another part of our lawsuit says, wait a minute, the current constitution prohibits commercialized gambling and affirmatively directs the legislature to pass laws to prevent it. This legislature has already passed laws that state how the constitutional amendment will be implemented, how gambling will be legalized and regulated. It's premature for this sitting legislature to even have addressed that issue. They have no power to do so. The power of the legislature to address how gambling will be legalized and if it should be legalized is dependent on what the people vote in November. So by doing this, the legislature hasn't just done what the legislature says it's going to do about gambling in the future. It's purporting to do it now before the people have even voted as to whether it's legal or not. In other words, the people have the right to amend the Constitution to direct the legislature to regulate gambling. Until and unless they do, it's premature to do it now. So that begs the question, why did the legislature do it now? The legislature did it now to put into place the geographical exclusivity that they guaranteed the tribe before the people have even voted on it.
So, Neil, if you were a betting man, does this pass on November 5th?
I like, again, betting. I don't know. I am not, I don't do polls, and I'm trying to focus on the legalities of this, so I wouldn't venture a guess on that. I really have no idea.
Okay. Well, we thank you for doing the legal part of it.
Okay.
we greatly appreciate your time, Neil. Good luck on behalf of the towns of Vernon and Verona, and we thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks. And the only other thing I would quickly add is it's not just about the people of Vernon and Verona. It's about all of us and how our Constitution is amended, and it shouldn't be up for sale.
That sounds like a very important point, because you're really saying that this is like vote buying.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. When you stripped of all its veneer, that's exactly it.
Welcome to Albany.
It's a sad situation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Okay.
Thanks,
Neil.
This is Frank Morrow, Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and we're here with Brian McDonald, the Legislative and Political Director of AFSCME New York, and Ron Deutsch, the Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. We only have a few minutes left, but before we finish up, Ron, bring our listeners up to date quickly on what's going on in the executive and legislative branches on the tax reform front, something that your organization and my organization both care deeply about.
Sure, I'd be happy to, and thanks for the opportunity. But I guess there are two things going on right now, right? And you talked about the first one, that the Senate is holding hearings on tax reform, generally very stilted hearings where they're just looking to hear from the business community, thereby invitation only. You were fortunate enough to get an opportunity to speak at that. I made an attempt to, but was rebuffed. They said they've heard from me before, and have heard enough from me, I guess. But the other reality is that the governor right now has a Tax Reform and Fairness Commission that's been meeting for about the last 6 or 7 months. And they've been meeting in private behind closed doors, and they're trying to devise a plan to create, I guess, more parity within our tax system, simplify our tax code when it comes to income taxes, sales taxes, and corporate taxes. And certainly that's an admirable goal, but much like the Senate is doing, I think that the governor's task force is also meeting kind of behind closed doors, hearing from who they want to hear from. And I think both of these processes need to be more open and more public. I think this is too important an issue for it to be negotiated behind closed doors. So we're hopeful that we'll let a little sunshine here, and we'll see how the people's business is being conducted in Albany and surrounding areas.
We're convinced that it's more than transparency or openness. That we think that if the Senate opened their hearings to the public, to regular people, they would hear what we've been hearing for years, that the tax that needs to be reformed and reduced is the property tax.
Absolutely.
So we think there's a substantive connection to this also, because both the governor's commission and the Senate seem to be focusing on business taxes, except as if some reform in the governor's case or a reduction in the Senate's case in business taxes is going to make the economy flower.
Right.
When it comes to having a good tax system, you have to remember the three traditional values of taxation: fairness, stability, and adequacy. And we think the people, if given a chance to speak, will really bring home the message that it's the property tax, stupid.
So I think that's very clear. I think the majority of people in this state, working in middle class families, the tax they hate the most is by far the property tax.
This is the people's business. Now stay tuned for Democracy Now! And we'll be with you again on October 3rd.